Posner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, host Margot Patterson talks with Hanan Ashrawi about what she characterized as the worse-than-apartheid system Palestinians in Israel live under, and how the Israeli justice system and penal system treats Palestinians. Host Jeff Humfeld talks with Matthew Hahn about living and working out of a California fire camp for 3 years of his incarceration, the benefits of the program to the inmate, the work he did in the camp, and the sense of accomplishment he got from the work. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here is Margot and her guest.
This is Margot Patterson with KKFI, Jaws of Justice Radio. I'm talking today to Palestinian legislator Hanan Ashrawi, familiar to many Americans and others around the world because she was the official spokesman for the Palestinian delegation to the Mideast peace talks for many years. Dr. Ashrawi is a member of the Executive Committee of the Palestine Liberation Organization, and she is here today to talk to us about what's going on, a little bit about what's going on in Palestine, a little bit about the situation of Palestinian prisoners, and I hope a little about her own life as a longtime advocate for human rights, women's rights, and of course, Palestinian rights. Dr. Ashrawi, before we start talking about prisoner issues, I'm wondering if you could talk just a little about this new reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas that was just announced, its chance for success and its significance.
Yes, it's a very significant moment, I think, in domestic Palestinian history, particularly because it ends a 10-year-long rift, a division that has been debilitating for Palestine and for Palestinian politics and for the standing of the Palestinian cause. So now the fact that there was a third-party intervention in a very active way, Egypt, and the fact that the international community has seen that the division and the rift has been very detrimental, not just to Palestinian democracy, but to the chances of peace, there was a convergence of positive factors. And the fact that an agreement has been signed dealing with all aspects of the division leads us to hope, even though Palestinians have learned to be afraid of hoping. But I think at this point we are seeing signs that there is a political will and there is external will, rather than exploiting the division, trying to end it in order to repair our Palestinian political system. This opens the door for a national unity government, it opens the door for elections, and for the revitalization of our institutions and our political system.
Is a national unity government necessary in order to have peace or make a peace agreement with Israel?
It certainly is necessary, because Israel always used the excuse that the Palestinians are divided, or whenever they reached any type of, let's say, close to an agreement, they would ask Mahmoud Abbas, whom do you represent? And the Americans actually at the Security Council used this as a justification, rationalization, why they rejected Palestinian statehood by saying you have to have control over all your land and all your people. And since you are divided and you don't control Gaza, they use that as a convenient excuse to vote against statehood. Now that there is reunification, hopefully, and the government of national accord will be able to take over Gaza and control different aspects of life, including borders, including the crossing points, the security, as well as resources, that would mean that the chances for peace are much better, that the excuse that we're not united will not be used against us, that if you have an inclusive representative democracy, that it will make your standing much better and your ability to represent all Palestinian people also better.
Well, since Jaws of Justice deals with the legal system, the justice system in this country, mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you a little bit about the legal rights of Palestinians on the West Bank and Gaza.
It's an oxymoron, say Palestinians and legal rights. We have no rights whatsoever, frankly speaking. I describe our situation under occupation as a situation of captivity and enslavement. We have no rights. Even the agreements that were signed, especially the Declaration of Principles and all subsequent agreements, are not honored by Israel. It builds more settlements, it confiscates more land, it steals our resources, it demolishes our homes, and it fragments Palestinian land in the West Bank with it. Hundreds of checkpoints, military control, and of course lays siege to Gaza, that has actually strangled Gaza and stopped any kind of development or created really a humanitarian disaster in Gaza. So, there is a legal system in Israel that applies only to Israeli Jews, and then there is a legal system that has discriminated against Palestinians in Israel, the indigenous people on whose lands Israel was created. And then you have military orders that govern our lives. And these military orders, many of them, are leftovers from the British Mandate. When the British withdrew from Palestine, they repealed the mandatory law, but Israel still uses it. This is the colonial legacy we're talking about. And that means you could get arrested, detained, administrative detention without trial, without reason, without evidence. You could be deported, your house could be demolished, and so on. You could have land taken away for supposedly security reasons or military reasons, and then the land is turned over to the settlers to take over. So you're vulnerable. The two components of a global system of justice, accountability for the occupation and protection for the vulnerable, for the occupied, do not exist at all.
I was astounded to read that, according to Rory McCarthy of the Guardian newspaper, something like 20% of the Palestinian population have at one time been in Israeli jails and prisons. Mm-hmm. In 2012, then Prime Minister Salam Fayyad stated that since 1967, 800,000 Palestinians had been imprisoned by Israel at one point. Mm-hmm. Again, roughly 20% of the total population and 40% of the male population. What is the situation today? Mm-hmm. How many Palestinians are in jail and are there without being charged with any crime?
Well, we have currently around 7,000 Palestinian in Israeli prisons. About 500 to 600 of them under what is called administrative detention, which is the leftover of the British colonial rule, where you are detained without charge, without evidence, without reason, and without trial. And this can be extended. You get detained for 6 months, and they can be extended 6 months at a time, without seeing a lawyer, without going to court, without due process in any way, shape or form. I mean, to be arrested in Palestine by the Israelis does not require any kind of evidence or any kind of justification. They've been arresting people for their posts on Facebook. They've been arresting people for demonstrating, protesting, and so on. A journalist was arrested for insulting the system in Israel. So we do have, in a sense, a massive prison, the West Bank and Gaza, including East Jerusalem, of course, in the West Bank. And then you do have within that prison an intricate system of prisons where you have a large number of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. 800,000, yes, is rather conservative. This, since 67, probably more now, closer to 900,000 or a million. That's the thing. People sometimes accept the Israeli labeling of all Palestinians as terrorists, and therefore Israel claims that all these people are terrorists. And Israeli, you're a terrorist if you protest, if you go on a march, If you write something Israel doesn't like, does that mean that everybody is a terrorist? It's a fact of life that you can get detained. I used to get detained all the time on occasions like the 5th of June or the Balfour Declaration, which is coming up, or just in, and they called it preemptive detentions to prevent us from protesting. So you end up in jail. I got beaten up on demonstrations repeatedly. Many of my friends did. My brother-in-law was deported. I was tried, arrested, and tried. So it's a factor of life. You have no protection. You have no legal rights. And the Israeli judicial system certainly has nothing to do with justice when it comes to Palestine.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the conditions in which prisoners are held. Are conditions better than they were, or worse, or about the same?
There was a massive prisoner strike, as you know. More than 1,000 prisoners went on a hunger strike for quite a long time. And then they came to agreements with the prison authorities, and they suspended the strike because they wanted several things. They wanted to be able to see their families, to have more than one visit, to be able to hold their children because they were not allowed to have any physical contact. They wanted to be able to study because when I was Minister of Higher Education, we did have an agreement with the Israelis that Palestinian prisoners can study. We used to send them also faculty and textbooks and so on to prison. This is, of course, they stopped that years ago. And they wanted to be able to study in prison. As you know, education is extremely important to Palestinians. And they were kept in really inhuman conditions without rights and isolation. So many of their demands were to stop the isolation cells, to stop, to allow them family visits, to allow them to study. Several, you know, most basic rights that people take for granted that they don't have. And of course they protested the ill treatment and torture, especially during interrogation, and the fact that Israel can hold you for at least, for as much as 90 days without seeing a lawyer or having any legal defense. So these are basic things that prisoners wanted. They didn't say we all want massive release. They said we want our rights even within the prison system. Unfortunately, Israel did not fulfill its promises or obligations, and prison conditions continue to deteriorate, particularly in congestion, and as I said, ill treatment, and the fact that, again, they are treated as though they don't deserve any rights, and that makes the situation much more difficult since they don't see a chance or any hope of things changing.
There have been a lot of concerns voiced about Palestinian youth being jailed, juveniles and really in some cases children.
Yes.
Has that number declined since 2016, when I understand that there was a surge in the detention of youth? And what are the conditions for Palestinian juveniles and children?
It's tragic. Actually, the number has increased. There are hundreds of children, minors, who are held in adult prisons and treated like adults. Many of them are threatened. Their violence is used against them, and they're threatened with more violence and with torture and with sexual assault. Actually, many of them are terrified. The way they come to their homes in the middle of the night and they abduct them or they take them. You could go to jail for throwing a stone at an Israeli occupation soldier. You could go to jail for shouting, yelling slogans. You could go to jail for refusing to listen to an order and so on. So these children, there are lots of studies now that have been done on Defense of Children International, DCI, and other organizations. Amnesty did that. I think Human Rights Watch did that, in which they showed that in Israel there is systematic abuse of children, of children's rights, violation of conventions and agreements on children globally that take place systematically and constantly. And actually the mere fact that you arrest children like that without any rights, and that you terrify them and you threaten them and you put them in inhuman conditions. And it's no wonder that the studies show that 80% of Palestinian children are traumatized, and they suffer from, it's not post-traumatic stress, but it is ongoing trauma.
A growing number of people have used the term apartheid to describe the situation in the Palestinian territories. Is that your term?
It's partially my term. I talked to Jimmy Carter, and I talked to many people who wrote about this. Many Palestinians use this as a description of the situation, but I would much rather use, and I'll be talking about this, the Ilan Pape description of the conditions as one of displacement-replacement rather than apartheid. I was good friends with Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, and I've been to South Africa, and I've gotten awards from South Africa, but and many delegations came to Palestine, and they tell us it's much worse than the situation of apartheid in South Africa, because in Palestine it's not a question of discrimination, it's a question of denial of the very fact of your existence, all your rights, all your history, your culture, everything, and an attempt to get rid of one people, one nation, and replace it with another. So it goes beyond just separation and discrimination and subjugation. It becomes displacement, replacement, which is what Ilan Pape described in his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine.
What do you think Americans should know about Palestine and Palestinians that they don't?
First they should begin by unlearning what they know, because quite often they are misled about the Palestinians. They don't get to the facts, they don't get to the truth, they don't understand, they don't see the Palestinians. Because for a long time, mainstream media had control over the public domain in terms of the depiction and the presentation of the Palestinian narrative and cause. Most of the time they were presented by the Israelis, and so the Israeli narrative and version was current in the U.S. And the fact that Israel is a domestic issue in the U.S. and is untouchable, so to speak, has led to the total exclusion and demonization and dehumanization of the Palestinians. So if you want me to tell the Americans what they should know, it's going to take more than one seminar. But let me say that I want them to look hard at the truth, to avoid these cliches and slogans and empty narratives, and even the false narratives that have been presented, the alternative facts that they're getting, and to try to reach the truth. I know it's difficult because we don't have the means of reaching the American public, but actually I'm beginning to see a change. I'm beginning to see a change from the days when I was a student and I was told that Palestinians don't exist. Or if we exist, we suffer the Aristotelian dualism of pity and fear, either pitiful refugees or fearful terrorists. So they began to see us in our humanity gradually as a people with rights, that ours was not a land without a people for a people without a land, that ours was a peopled land, and we were there with indigenous people. We've been there for hundreds of years. And I go back to the earliest Christian tradition and history, so you cannot negate my existence. And I think the American people have a sense of fair play and justice. And I know many people who, once their eyes are opened, once they know the truth and the facts, they have a sense of indignation. How come I didn't know? How come nobody told me? How come I believed the other version? How come I didn't see? We can't afford to wait till every American comes to Palestine to see what it's like. But at least within academic circles, within universities and activists and the solidarity movement, you are seeing now more and more of a courageous expression of Palestinian realities. And this is very important. And I think Americans deserve to know and they deserve to know what's being done in their name and with their tax money, and how Israel uses its influence through the pro-Israeli lobby in order to manipulate American politics to serve Israeli interests, even at the expense of American interests and standing. But the most important thing for me is to have the Americans understand the Palestinians, understand our narrative as a people who, by no fault of our own, our land was given away to another people to be made into a state that was imposed on Palestine. And all our lives we've been trying to get the most basic rights that other people take for granted.
One last question. You have been active in the struggle for Palestinian rights for 50 years, I think.
Yeah, at least.
What keeps you going? What keeps you getting up in the morning and continuing to work?
And being motivated, yes. I've been doing that for very, very long. What keeps me going, basically, I think, is a very positive motivation. It's that I love the Palestinian people, and I know that they have been victimized and maligned, and labeled and stereotyped and dismissed and denied. I think we have to struggle. We have to give them the voice, the presentation, and the rights that they need. And they deserve it. I mean, we deserve to be acknowledged. We deserve to have a politics of affirmation rather than denial. We deserve to be included among the community of nations. We deserve to live a normal life. We deserve, who was it who said, the quiet miracle of an ordinary life, of a normal life, which we've never had. And we have to end this vulnerability. We have to end this exploitation, this sense, the victimization constantly. And we have to tell our children and future generations now that there is hope, that the world can be a place of justice and fairness, even though right now it doesn't seem like it. And we need our people to understand also that they can live in freedom and dignity on their own land without constantly being either kicked out or ill-treated or blamed for their own situation. And the global rule of law will prevail. This is something I feel is a personal responsibility. It's a personal commitment. You don't choose it. I said once that when you're born a Palestinian, you're born with a challenge and a responsibility. And if you're a Palestinian woman, you have the dual responsibility, because you are, as they say, guilty by reason of nationality and gender. So you have to stand up for what is right, and you have to have the courage to do it. And you have to open doors, and you have to defy constraints and restrictions, and not just make the Palestinian narrative be heard, but make room for Palestinian rights and lives.
Well, Hanan Ashraoui, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the calendar for October 30th. The Kansas City chapter of Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum will be Friday, November 3rd, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. The KC Area Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide will hold their monthly meeting Friday, November 3rd, beginning at 7:30 p.m. at Our Lady of Sorrows Church, 2552 Gillum Road, KCMO. POMC meets to provide support and assistance through an ongoing emotional support, education, prevention, advocacy, and awareness to all survivors of homicide victims. State Representative Brandon Ellington is again hosting the annual basketball tournament to feed the hungry, and Voices of the People are hosting the 11th annual Community Thanksgiving Dinner. The basketball tournament is to help provide food and giveaway items for the Community Thanksgiving Dinner and will be held Wednesday, November 15th at the Brush Creek Community Center, 3801 Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard, KCMO. Team signups start at 5 p.m., and the games start at 6 p.m. Registration is one frozen turkey per player. Admission to game is at least 4 canned goods or 1 frozen turkey, or slightly used or new clothing or toys. The 11th Annual Community Thanksgiving Dinner will be held Wednesday, November 22nd from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Brush Creek Community Center, 3801 Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard, KCMO. All are welcome to attend. If you would like to volunteer to help with either of these events, you can contact Representative Ellington's office at 573-751-3129 or email at brandon.ellington@house.mo.gov. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Coming up next is Jeff and his guest, Matthew Hahn. There's an article that has been floating around the internet about incarcerated women in California that are fighting wildfires and risking their lives and health for slave wages. California has been using prisoners to fight fires for many years and makes no bones about it being a way to save a lot of money. This use of prisoners seems to many to be a perfect example of the exception clause of the 13th Amendment that allows one to be enslaved by the state if they have been convicted of a crime. Others see this as a form of community service for which prisoners are rewarded with shorter sentences and better conditions than they would have in prison. Today, we are going to talk once again with Matthew Hahn, author of the blog Hahn Scratch, about his time in prison in California. Matthew has written a blog post about his time as a firefighter for the state of California titled The Hesitita Firebreak.
Thanks for having me again, Jeff.
How long did you spend in prison, and how much of that time was at the fire camp?
On my second prison term, I spent about 7 years in prison, and I was in fire camp for the last 3 years.
Okay. What were the differences in the conditions at the fire camp and the prison? That is one of the things that made you want to do this, right?
Well, it's one of the many reasons for going to fire camp. I'd say a fire camp doesn't even remotely resemble a prison. It doesn't have any walls, doesn't have any gun towers. There's no armed guards. Even the guards that are in camp, like I said, they're not armed whatsoever. There's no locked doors. People tend to live in a dormitory. The doors aren't locked at night. Because fire camps tend to be located in areas where they can be near wildfires, they tend to be in nature. They tend to be in the mountains or in the wilderness. And so you kind of get to experience a very different setting than you would typically have when you're inside a prison, where you're lucky if you even get to see a horizon. You know, the visiting areas and camps look more like a park with picnic tables and barbecue pits. There tend to be lots of plant life and flowers and landscaping. Almost everything about the look of a fire camp is different. There's facilities for the prisoners there that you don't get while you're behind the walls. There's like hobby shops, places where you can do woodworking or metalsmithing or painting, things like that. There's a weight pile, you know, like a gym, which is an amenity that had gotten taken away from state prisons many years ago, but still remains available for fire camp inmates because, of course, they want us to be in good shape when we're out there fighting fires. So the conditions are significantly better. Oh, and the food is much better. They're not trying to restrict our calories. They want us to be well-fed and healthy.
The firefighting is only a small part of what these crews of prisoners would do or asked to do by the state. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the other things that you know, besides fighting fires that you might be called on to do?
So I guess we need to distinguish between, like, the emergency response aspect of being on a fire crew or in a fire camp, and then the maybe the community service aspect. When it comes to emergency response, we, of course, get called to fires, but there's also other incidents that we could get called out to. So if there's flooding going on, the camp inmates may go out and, you know, fill sandbags. If there's a, I recall one particular incident when I was in a Los Angeles County fire camp. There was a windstorm, I think maybe in 2010 or 2011, that took power out, that knocked trees down, and so the fire camp men were sent out to kind of clean up the neighborhoods, cut down the trees. There were a couple incidents in which our crews had got sent out to car accidents, actually, where specifically when a car would go off a road and maybe down a ravine, and emergency personnel had to get down to the car or, in some instances, the body. And the only way to do that was for a kind of a fire line or a trail to get blazed down the mountain, down to where the accident or the car had been located. And so our crews would go out and do things like that. So that's like the emergency response stuff. But then, of course, there's not an emergency going on every day during the work hours. And so what crews tend to do is they'll do trail maintenance. So go to your local state, county, parks, and maintain the trails that people enjoy hiking on. They will do brush clearance where there's brush that perhaps, if it was fire season, would threaten the homes there. Sometimes we'd be, it was actually rather interesting, sometimes we'd find ourselves in a park somewhere in the actually city proper of Los Angeles, cutting trees that had died down. And that was always an interesting experience because there's people jogging or people playing with their dogs or hanging out at the park, and we were also in the park just kind of cleaning up, cutting trees down, doing things like that. So that's kind of like the typical work that a person in a fire camp would do on any given day. Then, of course, if a call came in, we would leave that work and go respond to an emergency.
One of the things that's kind of a bone of contention, I think, for some folks is the how much money you get paid. You work, you know, doing the same work that people that make good wage fighting fires and all do, and you are making a pittance. What kind of wages were you making when you were in the fire camp?
Well, it depends on what job you have. Your average member of a fire crew makes about $1.35 to about $3 per day, and that's just for, like, the work duties. And that comes to you no matter what. And then there is the emergency response pay, which is $1 per hour. So if a firefighter, a man in camp, goes out to an emergency, then he would be getting, you know, the couple dollars per day plus $1 per hour for his time on the incident.
Did you volunteer to go to this duty, or were you drafted by prison authorities? And who's allowed to go to this duty and who isn't?
No, it's volunteer only. People in prison tend to want to go to fire camp if they have the opportunity to. In fact, I spent basically my first number of years in prison doing everything I could to be able to get there and be eligible for it. I can even go as far back as when I took my plea bargain. I structured my plea bargain to make sure that I was eligible for fire camp and that I would be eligible for the benefits of someone who goes there. And I'd say maybe half of the people who are in a fire camp are nonviolent offenders or people who are eligible for additional time work time credits for when they're there. So when I was there, I originally went there with a release date of November of 2013, but then because of the additional work time credits of being in a fire camp, I was released in February of 2012. So I basically got an additional 18 months off. But the other half of the inmates are not necessarily nonviolent, but they are people, if they've been convicted of a violent offense, who have spent many years proving themselves to be eligible to go there. So they're people who have not gotten write-ups, they haven't engaged in any violence behind the walls, and they, at some point, a camp counselor thought they were eligible to go out there. Now, you won't see people who are convicted of extremely serious violent crimes, but I have been there with people who've been convicted of robbery.
Okay. You know, what kind of training do you get? You get the same training that someone that hires on as a firefighter with the state of California would get, or is it different, or you go through the same camp where you learn, or what?
Well, no, we don't go through the same camp. So when we're getting trained, we definitely are in a prisoner fire camp training program. So I couldn't tell you whether we're getting the exact same training as someone who is in the free world doing a firefighter training. My guess is that it's different. But inmates are sent to one of two prisons in California where they do the training. And so in Northern California, there's a prison in Susanville. And then for Central and Southern California, they go to a prison in Jamestown. And that's where I've been sent. And the training pretty much entails a two-week like physical training regimen to ensure that the people that are going to camp are in good enough physical condition to be able to handle wildland firefighting. And that is, of course, behind the walls of the prison. And then once you've completed that, we go to a standard fire science or firefighter training, which is, I feel like it was 2 to 3 weeks long. I can't remember exactly how long it took, but it was relatively short. And it involved going to classes, and then, of course, doing safety training, and then eventually leaving the prison walls and getting tools and learning how to use the tools, which was a very interesting experience, having been in prison at that point for 4 years, getting driven to the mountains above the prison to go basically learn how to cut fire line. It's kind of awesome.
And that was mainly what your crew did, was cut fire lines. They didn't go in and actually try and fight fires directly, or is that what firefighting is? I guess most of us don't really know.
Well, yeah. Every crew within the California fire camp system is a hand crew. So we don't fight fires with water. But for the most part, wildland fires don't get fought with water. Of course, if you get the help of a helicopter or a plane dropping water or retardant down into the fire, you're definitely happy and grateful for it. But for the most part, hand crews are what create the containment around a wildfire. In some cases, no, you're not face-to-face with the fire because the fire is moving faster than you. It's moved ahead of you, and so you're cutting a line around it. But in many cases, you are actually head-to-head with the fire, especially sometimes with grass fires where you're trying to keep the grass fire from moving. You'll very often kind of follow it along and kind of basically steer its course. The fire that I wrote about in my blog post, the Hetzacita fire, was definitely a fire where we faced it head-on in the neighborhoods because the fires had been threatening homes. And, of course, we had to try to stop the fire dead in its track to keep it from burning more homes down.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that first fire and what it was like to ride in the vehicle and closed up and then... When you get there, you get out, and there's wall of flame right in front of you. What is that like? I mean, what went through your mind?
Well, the first time I saw in the Hetzacita fire, which was in Santa Barbara, was the first really large fire that I fought. I'd respond to a couple of small incidents prior to that, and had done some live fire training, but those were all kind of controlled or small incidents. And when we rounded the bend on Highway 1 and started to approach Santa Barbara, and all the guys in the back of the crew-carrying vehicle looked up to the mountain, and we saw, I don't know whether they were 50 or 100 foot high, you know, fingers of flames kind of like licking the sky, we had the realization that this was the real deal. And it was pretty terrifying. But at the same time, somewhere deep inside, I knew that this is what I signed up for. And so it was scary and anxiety-producing, but then we also were confident that, you know, we had good enough training and that our foreman with the L.A. County Fire Department wasn't going to put us in any sticky situations, so that we felt confident that we could handle it, but we also had to recognize it was dangerous. When we first stepped out of the vehicle, and like I said, it was kind of in a suburban neighborhood, and so we didn't see a wall of fire, but we knew that there was fire everywhere, and the sky was black or gray, and the sun was barely visible, and there was so much smoke in the air, it was very difficult to breathe. And I remember basically the first hour of firefighting on that fire, being so out of breath and always feeling like I was having a panic attack because there was so little oxygen. It was a rather terrifying experience, but we got through it, and after that, it starts to become routine or comfortable.
When you were in prison, you had different jobs while you were there in the facility. What's the difference in the sense of accomplishment when you've helped put out a fire than done the laundry at the prison or whatever job you might have had? You know, is there a different sense there?
Oh, of course there is. I don't think I would have much. I mean, I never worked in laundry, but I worked in like the scullery or something where I washed dishes, and I don't think I ever had a sense of pride or accomplishment whatsoever when working jobs like that behind the walls. But, I mean, I can take you back to that first big fire in Santa Barbara. I think we were there for 5 or 6 days, and when it was finally time for us to leave the fire, we went down a main street in Santa Barbara, and a lot of the neighborhoods had been evacuated, and so there was kind of people milling about everywhere, but this main street was lined with the people from neighborhoods, and they had, you know, kind of made signs that said, "Thank you, firefighters, thanks for saving my home," and there was just hundreds of people kind of out, like, watching us leave, and, you know, I really got a sense of accomplishment there, and I had a sense of pride that, you know, whatever work I'd done had benefited people, and, you know, I come back and I think of this one particular home that was threatened by fire there in Santa Barbara. And the way the fire was moving is there's these homes, and then there was kind of grass and brush in between the homes. So the fire was kind of zigzagging through the various homes in these neighborhoods. And we were following that fire around between the homes, and we got to a house where basically the back porch was on fire. And this was like a wooden porch that had been attached to the house. And realizing that we couldn't save the porch, but we could save the house, our SAW team and the rest of the crew cut off the porch. We cut the porch off of the house and took the burning embers and the burning portion of it back into the burn where it wouldn't threaten the house anymore. And I often think about the people when they get home and they go into their house and they pull into their driveway and they think about the fact, my house has been saved. And then perhaps they went into their living room and they looked out the window to their backyard and realized just how close their house came to being burned down because the deck had to get removed in order to save it. And I'm sure they just thought it was firefighters, and they probably had no inkling that it had been incarcerated men who had saved their house. And there's definitely a sense of pride in moments like that.
You know, I'm going to have to ask you about how you feel about this controversy, the slavery versus community service discussion that I mentioned at the beginning. Now that you're out, and also now that you are out, could you apply and get a job as a firefighter?
Personally, I could not, but it doesn't have to do with my felonies.
Okay.
I've got a completely different reason for not being able to apply to the fire department. But I should mention that the firefighter training we get in there is very specific to wildland firefighting.
Yeah.
So the only firefighting that would be available would be where you're fighting wildfires or forest fires. Ironically, the CAL FIRE, which is the one that trains us, the organization that trains us in prison, will not hire felons. I've heard of special cases where they do, but for the most part, state agencies don't hire felons. The LA County Fire Department, which is the fire department that I was a member of when I was in fire camp, also does not hire felons. The U.S. Forestry, on the other hand, and you've probably heard of hotshot crews, but
right.
U.S. Forestry does hire felons. So. And in fact, there's one man in particular I'm thinking of that I was in fire camp with that currently works for U.S. Forestry. So it's not completely barred to them, but you're correct in thinking that the bulk of the firefighter positions available are not available to felons. Now, as far as the slavery versus community service question goes, I think it's a sticky, tricky question because, on one hand, from an objective level or maybe from the perspective of people in the outside world, yes, it looks like we're getting paid very, very little money. And in reality, we are getting paid very, very little money. But it also happens to be the best paid job in the entire prison system. And it also happens to be a place where we get treated the most humanely in the entire prison system. Almost every incarcerated man or woman in the state of California would love to go to fire camp if they had the opportunity. And sometimes when I see the discussion about firefighters as an example of slavery within the California prison system, I worry that it could lead to the fire camp system, the fire camp program, actually going away. And particularly if they wanted to raise wages to such an extent that there was no cost reason for even keeping the fire camp system. And the net result of that would be that there would be 4,000 or so prisoners of the state of California who would end up living back behind the walls rather than living in the most humane environment available to them. I think it's also important to remember that it is volunteer, and we get money as well as work time credits. So, like I said, I would have gotten released a year and a half later if I had not gone to fire camp. So I think there's like a different perspective perhaps for the men on the inside than there is for the people on the outside. And maybe I have a bias in that respect. But the fact of the matter remains is I was happy to be there. I would never have wanted to be anywhere else. And that was the attitude of most of the other men that I lived with there.
I want you to tell our listeners how they would find your blog. And also, maybe you can tell us, last time we talked to you, you were working on a book. Has that gotten any further along, or are we maybe going to see that on the shelves here for long?
Well, I'm still working on the book. I am working with an agent, and I've also got some other things in the work, which I may be announcing here in the relatively near future, but I'll keep that under wraps for the moment. You can find my writing at hanscratch.com, which is H-A-H-N. S-C-R-A-T-C-H, hanscratch.com. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram if you enjoy those social media platforms with the same name, H-A-H-N, Scratch. I'm working on the book. I'm working with an agent, and hopefully I'll get that finished within the next year or so.
Well, we want to thank you very much for coming on and telling us a little bit about this issue. I know it's one that's got a lot of people up in arms, and, as with most of these issues, there's more than one side, and there's good that comes from some of these programs, even if they do seem to be exploitive.
Well, I agree, and that's why I don't think it's a black or white issue, that care needs to be taken when objecting to something. Particularly an accusation as serious as slavery, right? When objecting to something, I think care needs to be taken to think about what the experience is like for the men who are actually fighting the fires and living in the fire camps, and how important a program such as that is to them.
Well, Matthew, we want to thank you very much for coming on today, and we'll be keeping in touch with you.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
Okay, I'm here at the DPA conference. It's still day one. I'm with Mr. Ira Glasser, former head of the ACLU, one of the founding members and a staunch ally of the Drug Policy Alliance. We got people from around the world. We got folks enthusiastic about making change. Your summation of this conference, please.
Well, I started going to these conferences when I was still at the ACLU, 30 years ago in the late 80s, when it was a predecessor organization, the Drug Policy Foundation, which was before the Drug Policy Alliance, but the Drug Policy Alliance ended up merging and becoming the successor to the Drug Policy Foundation. And in those days, there were maybe 150 people at these conferences. And it was all white vanilla, it was not that there weren't people in the room who were suffering from repressive drug laws, but they were mostly, white stoners who wanted to smoke marijuana. And that was a legitimate enough issue by itself. But I always knew from my work at the ACLU that the primary victims of repressive drug laws were black and brown folks who were the ones who were getting arrested and persecuted and prosecuted and imprisoned and for excessively long sentences. And that was during the time in the 80s when the prison population was exploding, primarily because of the expansion of the imprisonment of nonviolent drug offenders. And they weren't in the room. And it took a long time to get them there, in part because the movement itself was so insular and small at the time that they had no connection to the folks who were not like them, who were suffering. But it was also because black leadership, if you went into the churches and you try to talk about this problem, you got your head handed to you. Black leadership saw drugs as the problem. They didn't see drug laws as the problem. They didn't see the expansion of police discretionary authority as the problem. It took a long time for whites in the movement to become sensitive to the people outside the movement who were the main victims of drug laws. And it took time for black leadership to begin to understand why the drug laws were so repressive and such an instrument of racism. So, you know, when we first started talking about that problem back, you know, 30 years ago in the room, I never really thought too many people, if anybody, really understood what we were saying. But now you look at it today and there's 1,500 people here from 30 or 40 countries.
You can hear the full interview on the October 20th Cultural Baggage, DeanBeckerDrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.